Welcome to today's reading of the San Angelo Standard Times, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'm reading the San Angelo Standard Times newspaper for the week of Sunday, July 24th, 2022. We have relatively few locally written articles in the Standard Times this week. We'll begin with what we have, and then we'll move on to Texas articles. And then we have a few local sports articles to read. And then finally, we'll wrap up with a couple of feature columns. U.S. Highway 67 project at Paul Ann and Tractor Trail now complete, by Charles Bryce, published July 27th. Nearly 4 years after it started, the U.S. Highway 67 project at Paul Ann Boulevard and Tractor Trail has been completed as motorists traveled on the overpass for the first time Tuesday afternoon. The project, which began in November 2018, is the largest one that the Texas Department of Transportation, TxDOT, has completed in San Angelo, coming at a cost of around $40 million. Reese Albert Incorporated was awarded the project. That stretch of the highway has now been updated to freeway standards. The Curtis J. Whitlock Memorial Overpass at Tractor Trail is named in honor of an employee who worked at TxDOT for more than 30 years. He died of cancer during the production of this project, said Karen Threlkeld, the public information officer for the San Angelo District. He was here for the groundbreaking, and I know he's still watching us build it. Threlkeld said the public has been anticipating the opening of the new overpass for some time now. People that drive this area every day notice that it's looking almost finished, so people are aware, Threlkeld said. It really upgrades the whole area, and the overpasses at Paul Ann and Tractor Trail really improves the safety in the area. And now here are Texas-related articles. Little-known Texas telephone service charge is about to go up by 700%. Facing a court order, the Public Utility Commission increases the monthly charge that ensures rural Texans have access to telephone service. By John C. Moritz, Corpus Christi Times, published July 26th in the San Angelo Standard Times. Austin. Telephone customers will see an increase in the monthly bills beginning effective August 1st because of a court order that state regulators fully fund a long-standing program that ensures Texans in hard-to-reach places have access to phone service, which under law is a public necessity. The action by the Public Utility Commission raises what is likely a little-noticed line item called the Universal Service Fund on monthly phone bills that's calculated at 3.3% of the cost for interstate voice service to 24%. That's about a 700% boost. But the 3.3% charge for many single-line cellular customers worked was as low as 30 cents a month. For them, the cost will raise to around $2 a month. However, for some landline customers with high long-distance bills, the increase could be considerably more. The increase, adopted unanimously with little discussion July 14th, came after the Texas Third Court of Appeals, the week before, ruled in favor of several telephone companies that sued the PUC on grounds that it had shortchanged them to the tune of more than $200 million in legally required subsidies to offset the high cost of bringing phone service to some of Texas's most desolate outposts. Without that service, millions of rural Texans might not have access to 911 in the event of an emergency and might be hard-pressed to manage farming and ranching businesses. But the PUC's action offer a mixed blessing, said Mark Seal, executive director of the Texas Telephone Association. I need to be real clear that we didn't ask for this. We certainly didn't ask for an almost 700% increase, said Seal, whose organization was part of the lawsuit decided by the Third Court. We initially advocated for a much lower assessment and a much longer payout. The companies brought the court action after the PUC in 2020 rejected a modest increase in the Universal Service Fund, which would have brought the levy to 6.4%, And in 2021, Governor Greg Abbott vetoed a measure aimed at addressing the decline in USF collections as more phone customers opt to disconnect from landline and use only cell service. In his veto message, Abbott said he killed the legislation because it would expand the number of people paying fees. However, Lee Watkins, the chief operating office for a satellite phone company that services Texans in the Big Bend region, who not only have access to landlines, but also almost zero access to reliable cell service, said his company was on the verge of closing its doors until the commission acted. Last month, the company, Dial Tone Services, notified customers they would have to look elsewhere for phone service and would likely have to pay much steeper bills. "It's a big relief for our customers," said Watkins, who noted that many first responders in the Big Bend rely on satellite phones to communicate with each other and with Texans in need of immediate emergency service. "We anticipate being able to stay in business." At a hearing of the Texas Senate Business and Commerce Committee this month, several lawmakers said changes to the Universal Service Fund, which was established in 1987 in Texas and dates back to a New Deal-era federal program that aimed to make sure rural Americans could be connected. Among the problems in Texas, parts of the state that were considered rural in the 1980s are now part of Texas's ever-burgeoning network of suburbs, committee members noted. Meantime, Seal said phone companies that are part of his association are expecting some blowback when their customers see an unexpected jump in their next phone bill. "We're still open to talking to the PUC and lawmakers about a longer, more affordable increase in the assessment to address this over a period of years, not over a period of months," Seal said. "And we are all bracing for the rate shock that our customers are going to have. They will call and ask us, why did this happen?" Police say woman who opened fire at Dallas airport shot at cop. The Associated Press published Thursday, July 28th. Surveillance footage released by police shows people ducking behind kiosks, falling to the ground, and running as Odafua begins firing. Dallas. The woman accused of firing several gunshots inside a Dallas airport faces a charge of aggravated assault of a public servant because she allegedly fired one round toward a police officer, according to a warrant. The officer shot and wounded Portia Odufua, who was taken to a hospital after Monday's shooting at Dallas Love Field Airport. Dallas Police Chief Eddie Garcia said at a Tuesday news conference that Odufua, who is prohibited from possessing a firearm, could face additional charges. Odufua, who had no luggage, entered the ticketing area, then went into a restroom, emerging with her hands in the pockets of a hooded sweatshirt, according to the arrest warrant. Garcia said that she was then walked into the ticketing area and said she had an announcement to make. Witnesses say Odufua started to ramble, talking about a marriage, incarceration, and that she was going to blow up the airport, and then pulls a handgun from her sweatshirt, Garcia said. She fired two rounds into the ceiling before Dallas officer Ronald Cronin told her to drop the weapon, and she then fired in his direction, the arrest warrant said. Garcia said Cronin took cover behind a self-check-in kiosk and fired, striking her multiple times. Cronin was not struck, nor was anyone besides Odufua. Surveillance footage released by police shows people ducking behind kiosks, falling to the ground, and running as Odufua begins firing. Garcia lauded Cronin's actions, saying he not only didn't hesitate in engaging the suspect, but also tried to help guide others into an area of safety. "I know his actions saved lives and prevented more injuries," Garcia said. Jail records do not list an attorney who is representing Odufua. Garcia has said Odufua was shot in her lower extremities. He said Tuesday that she had undergone surgery and was stable. Operations at Love Field, one of the Dallas-Fort Worth area's two major airports, were suspended for hours and dozens of flights were canceled following the shooting. Garcia said authorities are still investigating a motive, but Odufua has been arrested several times in recent years and has been found incompetent for trial more than once. A judge last year found her incompetent to stand trial after she was charged with making a false report, court records show. The judge found that she wasn't a danger to others and referred her to outpatient mental health services. In that case, she was accused of pulling a fire alarm at a hotel after her request to extend her stay was denied, according to police in the Dallas suburb of Mesquite. Records show the charge was dismissed. In 2019, she was found incompetent for trial in a bank robbery in suburban Wiley, the Dallas Morning News reported. She underwent treatment, and court records show the case was eventually dismissed. Also that year, she was arrested for arson after telling a police officer who had responded to a house fire in Mesquite that she started it and was God's prophet, according to a police report. She also told police she was married to singer Chris Brown, the police report said. The Dallas County District Attorney's Office said that charge was rejected for lack of scientific evidence to support a conviction. On Monday at the airport, she was also heard making comments about Brown, according to the arrest warrant. Garcia said that Odufua has been prohibited from possessing a firearm since August 2018. He said police were working with federal authorities to figure out where she got the gun. It wasn't hers. It was not registered to her. Obviously, she got it from somebody else, but we're trying to figure out precisely where, Garcia said. And now from the front page of the San Angelo Standard-Times, published Sunday, July 24th. Difficult times. Heat and drought bring pain for farmers and ranchers. By Bob Schiller, Austin American Statesman. Lampasas County rancher Mickey Edwards describes the grass on much of his spread as crunchy, dry, and dusty. His plan to cope with the conditions was to feed his cattle bales of hay from last year's harvest until a stock pond dried up, prompting him to sell off about 40 animals, or more than 15% of his herd, because they had nothing to drink. "We ran out of surface water, one on one of the pastures," Edwards said. "We hope we can get through this with the rest of the cattle. It's going to depend on how extensive this drought is." Across Texas, farmers and ranchers are facing similar difficult decisions amid the intense heat and lack of rain. In Ellis County near Waxahachie, John Paul Deneen began harvesting his corn crop in mid-July, joining many corn growers in the state who started a couple of weeks earlier than usual because the extremely high temperatures caused plants to mature ahead of schedule. But that doesn't mean it's a good crop. Not much corn worth harvesting came up, Deneen said, and his stalks that did were only 5 feet tall at most, compared with 6 to 7 feet normally. "Yields are 50% of an average year," he said. "We might get 50 bushels per acre, well below the 100 to 110 bushels typically." With nearly 85% of Texas now suffering under a severe to exceptional drought and no relief in sight from the scorching 100-plus degree days, the people who make their living from the land are having nerve-wracking flashbacks to 2011, the state's hottest summer on record and its worst year in terms of drought-related agricultural losses. Will this year's drought rival 2011? The toll that the 2011 drought extracted from Texas farmers and ranchers has been estimated at $7.62 billion by Texas A&M University's AgriLife Extension Service, a financial blow that was only partially softened by insurance payments, and that equates to about a third of annual gross revenue from production of agricultural commodities statewide. Farmers who planted crops that year, ranging from cotton to corn to wheat and sorghum, suffered from ruined harvests or extremely poor yields. Ranchers were forced to pay big bills to buy feed and water for livestock when grass died and stock ponds evaporated, or to sell cattle at low prices if they opted to cull herds amid the glut of animals being auctioned in the rush to cut losses. Opinions vary on whether 2022 will end up rivaling 2011 in terms of the most nightmarish year for Texas agriculture. Significant pain is expected either way. "This corn crop is bad, but it's not 2011 bad," said Dustin Owen, general manager of Williamson County Grain, a storage elevator in Taylor. "The crop of 2011 was most certainly the worst I've ever seen." But Owen made clear that this year isn't shaping up to be a picnic for the farmers. The 2022 corn crop is on track to be the second or third poorest in his memory, he said. Still, he said, scattered rainfall in the area helped the recent wheat harvest come in better than he initially expected, given overall conditions. With the corn harvest currently underway, he said some local producers are yielding only 35 to 40 bushels per acre, which is in the ballpark of 2011's meager totals for cornfields that managed to come up at all. But others appear to be doing okay. It's definitely a reduction from previous years when conditions weren't as hot and dry, Owen said of the Williamson County harvest. But there are some pockets of decent corn out there. Statewide, however, they're in the minority. Devastating for farmers. According to the most recent survey by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, 42% of Texas corn acreage is in poor or very poor condition, while only 3% is in excellent condition, and 22% is in good condition. David Gibson, executive director of Texas Corn Producers, a trade group, said the prevailing weather pattern throughout the growing season has been devastating for many farmers. When I add it all up, this seems worse to me than 2011, Gibson said. We've got producers that didn't get any crop up or poor emergence, and the crop died early on, to reports consistent with 30 to 40% of normal yields or less among those who were able to bring in a harvest. With much of 2022 remaining and some harvests still to come, such as the state's big cotton harvest this fall, Texas A&M agricultural economists haven't weighed in yet with an overall forecast for agricultural losses. But they already know the tally will be big. We are looking at significant losses this year across the agriculture sector, said Mark Welch, grain marketing economist for Texas A&M's AgriLife Extension Service. It has the potential to rival 2011. Difficult times for cattle industry. A major portion of the financial hit is expected to be attributable to losses related to cattle, by far the state's largest agricultural commodity, with prices for supplemental feed climbing as grass disappears and as many ranchers cull herds to try to stay afloat. An estimated 85% of rangeland and pastures across Texas is in poor or very poor condition, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And livestock auctions statewide have reportedly been full in recent weeks with cattle for sale. That's a repeat of what happened in 2011 when the size of the Texas cattle herd dropped 8%, or by about 410,000 animals, to 4.5 million. Texas A&M's report on the 2011 drought pegged about $3.23 billion of the estimated $7.62 billion in agricultural losses that year, or 42%, on financial pain suffered by the livestock industry. David Anderson, a livestock economist at Texas A&M, said the state's herd of beef cattle probably will take another sizable hit this year. The Texas herd, which is the biggest in the country, began 2022 at just under 4.5 million animals, down from 4.64 million in 2021, because issues such as inflation for feed and fuel were already prompting some ranchers to reduce their operations. These are pretty difficult times for ranchers, Anderson said. There will be some people who really are forced to sell everything if the weather doesn't improve. Kerry Wiggins, newly elected president of the Independent Cattlemen's Association of Texas, agreed with that assessment, saying he's already aware of some who have sold all their cattle with the aim of restocking when the drought breaks. His small spread in Milam County has sufficient grass and water, but he said that's not the case for many others. It's hot and dry, and pastures are burning up as we speak, said Wiggins, a part-time rancher who has about 50 head. I doubt it's the worst ever in terms of conditions, but it's not good, and it's got the potential to get a lot worse. An added frustration for many in the agriculture industry is that commodity prices have been high, but they've been unable to take advantage of them. For instance, a benchmark contract in the corn futures market was trading recently at about $5.75 per bushel, up about 15% in the past year. When you've got no corn to sell, a good price doesn't keep you in business, said Gibson, head of the state's Corn Growers Association. He also said inflation in the costs of fertilizer, fuel, and other inputs forced many farmers to spend heavily this year, with little to show for it when crops went bust. The way we are going, we could easily see losses that are similar to 2011. From the front page of Friday, July 22nd, Standard Times, two indicted in migrant deaths case, 53 perished in trailer abandoned in Texas, by Terry Wallace, Associated Press. Two men were indicted Wednesday in the case of a hot, airless tractor-trailer rig found last month with 53 dead or dying migrants in San Antonio, officials said. A federal grand jury in San Antonio indicted Homero Zamorano Jr., 46, and Christian Martinez, 28, both of Pasadena, Texas, on counts of transporting and conspiring to transport migrants illegally, resulting in death, and transporting or conspiring to transport migrants illegally, resulting in serious injury. Both remain in federal custody without bond pending trial. Martinez's attorney, David Shearer of San Antonio, declined to comment on the indictments. A message to Zamorano's attorney was not immediately returned. Conviction on the death counts could result in life sentences, but the Attorney General's office could authorize prosecutors to seek death penalties. The serious bodily injury counts carry sentences of up to 20 years in prison. It was the deadliest tragedy to claim the lives of migrants smuggled across the border from Mexico. The truck had been packed with 67 people, and the dead included 27 from Mexico, 14 from Honduras, 7 from Guatemala, and 2 from El Salvador, said Francisco Garduño, chief of Mexico's National Immigration Institute. The incident happened on a remote San Antonio back road on June 27th. Arriving police officers detained Zamorano after spotting him hiding in some nearby brush, according to a statement from the U.S. Attorney's Office. A search of Zamorano's cell phone revealed calls with Martinez concerning the smuggling run. Surveillance video of the 18-wheeler passing through a Border Patrol checkpoint showed the driver matched Zamorano's description, according to the indictment. One survivor of the journey, a 20-year-old from Guatemala, told the Associated Press that smugglers had covered the trailer's floor with what she believes was powdered chicken bouillon, apparently to throw off any dogs at the checkpoint. The tragedy occurred at a time when huge numbers of migrants have been coming to the U.S., many of them taking perilous risks to cross swift rivers and canals and scorching desert landscapes. Migrants were stopped nearly 240,000 times in May, up by one-third from a year ago. Rural Texas districts struggling to attract teachers are switching to four-day school weeks, by Brian Lopez, Texas Tribune, published July 22nd. At the end of April, the Mineral Wells Independent School District, located about 50 miles west of Fort Worth, lost one of its most treasured educators. After teaching there for decades, the teacher was a long-standing community member. Then in early May, the district lost six more teachers over a 10-day period. It was a worrisome trend for the small district, which has about 3,000 students and employs about 500 staff members, including some 230 teachers. School administrators found they were leaving to teach in neighboring districts that were operating on four-day school weeks, usually Monday through Thursday. "We started losing teachers to that four-day school week, regardless of what we paid," said David Tarver, assistant superintendent of Mineral Wells ISD. "That was a big eye-opener. The school had to adapt." The school board voted on May 17th to make the switch to a four-day week, starting with the 2022-2023 school year. The action was needed to attract and retain teachers during a time when educators are hard to come by. "We had teachers that had multiple offers from our school district and a neighboring school district that were waiting on our board to vote whether we were going to do 4 days or 5 day weeks," Tarver said. "We gained some leverage on being able to recruit teachers." The switch to 4 day school weeks has recently become popular among smaller and rural school districts across Texas that need an attractive incentive to recruit and retain teachers, and that don't always have the financial resources to dish out dramatic pay increases like in bigger cities. The Mineral Wells District's base pay is $45,000 for teachers, but it pales in comparison to districts like the Houston Independent School District, the largest district in the state, which has raised the starting salary to teachers to $61,500 for this school year, up from $56,869 in the 2021-22 school year. The Houston district has no intention to going to four-day school weeks. Other rural districts have made the same jump to four-day school weeks as they deal with unfilled positions and retention issues. Small rural districts in various parts of the state, such as Devers, Athens, Jasper, and Chico, have also made the switch. In Texas, schools have to be open for a minimum of 75,600 minutes over a school year, which includes recess and lunch. Districts have control over how these minutes are spread out, giving flexibility to schools to adopt the four-day model. Some are adding time to each of the four remaining school days to make up for the extra day off. Others are extending the school year. Jasper ISD is one of the districts that has said the school day will not be extended. The move to have shorter school weeks dates back to the Great Recession, when school districts were looking for ways to save money. Now in 2022, the four-day school week also allows districts to trim back on operational costs, but the savings are relatively minimal. This effort is seen solely to remain competitive in the workforce market. Education policy researchers say more and more rural districts in states like Texas and Missouri are moving to the shorter work week model, especially after the pandemic caused widespread teacher burnout across the country. While there isn't conclusive evidence that the shorter schedule harms or improves educational outcomes, school officials across the state will be watching how Texas school districts fare, said Kevin Brown, executive director of the Texas Association of School Administrators. Emily Morton, a research scientist at the Northwest Evaluation Association, who has studied the impacts of a four-day week in Oklahoma schools and students, said the schedule has a small but negative effect on test scores. The NWEA is a nonprofit that studies education issues. "One thing we don't know yet is how much the four-day schedule matters," Morton said. Staying competitive. For the last 10 years, the Chico Independent School District has been affected by declining enrollment and a shrinking workforce. The solution for the rural district, located about 50 miles northwest of Fort Worth, was approving the four-day week starting this upcoming school year. "Anybody that had eyes or ears knew that this impending teacher shortage was coming, and our view was it was only going to get worse for the foreseeable future," said Chico ISD Superintendent Randy Brawner. "You just can't go out and throw money at your problems. You have to think outside the box and think creatively." Morton said the Oklahoma school districts she's researched has implemented four-day school weeks as a cost-saving measure, and that she hasn't seen the shorter schedule being used as an incentive for teachers to stay or parents to move into a district before. In that sense, Texas is unique. "In most cases, teachers and families are thrilled with a four-day week. There are concerns from parents over childcare on Fridays, but Morton said she didn't find conclusive evidence that it was a major problem for parents in Oklahoma. In rural communities, which tend to be home to multi-generational families, kids usually spend their Fridays either working with their parents or at a relative's house. There's a different sort of labor market in those areas," Morton said. "They are often working non-traditional Monday to Friday schedules, and the districts often are a huge employer in these areas." Still, school districts in Texas know shrinking the school week is a monumental shift from the norm, and some are offering accommodations for families. Chico ISD has given the choice of a five-day week to its special education population. In Mineral Wells, the district is currently figuring out which families need the school to be open on Fridays and how to accommodate them. Morton said schools that switch to the shorter week almost never go back to five-day weeks unless the state requires it. Her research shows that the shorter schedule keeps teacher morale up and student discipline incidents low. "Students are in school less, right? So some of it you would expect to reduce," she said. "One big caveat is we don't know what's happening outside of school." Downsides. While there are noticeable positives in changing to a four-day week, Morton is hesitant to give the policy a universal endorsement. She has concerns over whether it's a sustainable incentive. For one, if every district started doing it, districts that implement it would have no more leverage. A study in Colorado also found that adolescent students may engage in more criminal activity as a result of the extra day off. Morton also is worried about children who aren't in safe households and for whom school represents a safe space. Dan Robinson, Associate Dean of Research in the College of Education at the University of Texas at Arlington, said he fears for the low-income students in these districts because they may get lunch for free or low cost at their schools. So if they're not in school on Fridays, that is one less day that they might have that meal. I'm afraid the poor groups out there would be negatively affected, Robinson said. Robinson added that the trade-off of the shorter schedule often is having longer school days, which he thinks might not be a good thing for children. By opting out of the pacing that a five-day week allows, it might seem like schools are trying to cram lessons. It also remains to be seen if the trend moves to bigger districts, which also have staffing and retention issues. Tarver of the Mineral Wells ISD said he isn't worried so much about his neighboring districts moving to the shorter week model, but is concerned about the big ones. If they offer it, the four-day schedule will be another perk to lure teachers to larger districts, in addition to higher salaries and better housing options. It is unlikely big school districts would make the switch anytime soon, though. Robinson believes they can, and it would help them solve things like traffic congestion. Brian Woods, superintendent of Northside Independent School District in the San Antonio area, the fourth largest district in the state, said it's unlikely his or other big school districts would go down the four-day route. Woods said his school days are already over 7 hours long and isn't sure his students, especially the younger ones, would have the capacity to be in school any longer if they were to get Friday off. He's also worried about childcare, as it can be harder to find in more urban and suburban areas. We've got a responsibility to our own staff and to the parents, Woods said. But Woods understands why the rural areas move to the shorter schedule as a need to attract talent. He said he won't close the door on the idea for his district because he doesn't know how bad the labor shortage could get. Districts like Houston also would rather increase pay and give raises than cut down the school week. We believe maximizing instructional time is critical to accelerating learning outcomes, especially as students recover from learning loss resulting from the COVID-19 pandemic, the district said in a statement. It's also much easier to pivot 600 or so kids into a new schedule rather than thousands of them. I always use the analogy of a stream versus a river, Bronner said. It's easier to divert the course of a stream than it is a river. Some rural schools say they wouldn't switch over to the four-day model if they didn't have to. It puts a microscope on me, my administrative staff, and my teachers, Bronner said. But if we weren't facing a teacher shortage and the loss in enrollment, we would definitely have stayed in a five-day traditional calendar. Has Abbott moved on from Uvalde? He called the latest report beyond disturbing, but has offered few solutions. The governor's office says Greg Abbott prefers not to intrude on families of mass shootings as they grieve privately. By John C. Moritz, Corpus Christi Caller Times, published in the San Angelo Standard Times, July 22nd, Austin. Governor Greg Abbott is taking political heat for not attending funerals for the 21 victims of the massacre in Uvalde, leading some to suggest that the two-term Republican is indifferent to the deep sorrow that has engulfed the community since May 24th. Ordinarily, Abbott's absence from any single funeral that followed a horrific event would have gained scant notice and little, if any, media attention. In the five highest-profile mass shootings in Texas since Abbott assumed office in 2015, the governor has purposely avoided any actions that might be seen as intruding on a family's private grief, his spokeswoman said. Instead, he has chosen to take part in community-wide public memorials. Governor Abbott has been to the community of Uvalde multiple times, visiting with every family who requested a meeting, and joining his fellow Texans to grieve and worship at events, said Press Secretary Renee Ease. Many families requested private funerals, and the governor and first lady instead sent flowers and condolences to let the loved ones know they remain in their prayers. Ease's statement came after numerous media outlets seized on recent remarks on MSNBC by State Senator Roland Gutierrez, a Democrat whose district includes Uvalde, that Abbott did not go to one single funeral, and quite honestly, many of the families didn't want him there. I don't want this to sound like some political assault on him, but at the end of the day, he hasn't been there since day five, since the president came, Gutierrez said in an interview broadcast nationally. With the November election just 4 months away, and with his approval rating sagging, Abbott can ill afford to be seen as uncaring about Uvalde's continuing sorrow, experts said. Cal Gilson, a political science professor at Dallas's Southern Methodist University, said Abbott's early misleading statements regarding the Uvalde shooting that were then compounded by conflicting accounts of the law enforcement response, and finally the video showing armed officers delaying more than an hour before storming the classroom, tend to magnify anything that might be perceived as a slight by the governor. Abbott is taking fire for the actions of local law enforcement, the Texas Department of Public Safety, and the rest, Gilson said. So the political question, not necessarily the moral question, is what are the steps he needs to take to stem the tide of criticism? Is it attending funerals? Is it a stronger statement on police performance? Is it a stronger statement on policy? That's what Abbott's political team needs to figure out. Ease pointed out that Abbott's actions in the aftermath of Uvalde differed little from his approach to the previous mass shootings during his time in office. 5 days after the shooting, the governor accompanied President Joe Biden and First Lady Jill Biden to visit Robb Elementary, where they laid flowers at what had become a shrine to the victims outside the school building. After Sutherland Springs in November 2017, Abbott was with then-Vice President Mike Pence at a memorial service at the local high school football field. The governor greeted then-President Donald Trump when he arrived at the airport in El Paso to comfort the survivors and victims' families after the deadly mass shooting in August 2019. The governor also took part in the public memorial service after the shooting at Santa Fe High School in May 2018. Uvalde, however, has presented a unique challenge for Abbott. At his initial news briefing in the community, he was accosted by Democratic rival Beto O'Rourke, who faulted the governor directly for not taking action to limit the availability of guns despite the frequency of mass shootings in Texas. O'Rourke's action, first heavily criticized as inappropriate for the circumstance, appeared to gain some positive traction as Abbott's initial statement praising law enforcement's action as heroic unraveled in the days that followed. By the time Biden visited Uvalde, several people attending the otherwise quiet event booed the governor as he approached the shrine to lay his bouquet. Harvey Kronberg, the publisher of the Capitol-focused Quorum Report since 1989, said Abbott has proven less adept at conveying empathy than his recent predecessors. Kronberg also pointed out O'Rourke, who trails Abbott by single digits in recent polling, has held both public and private events with Uvalde families, which likely helps drive the narrative that Abbott is less engaged compared with his Democratic rival. The public confrontation by O'Rourke, followed by the booing at the Biden event, Kronberg said, may have gotten inside of Abbott's head regarding Uvalde. Abbott did not attend Sunday's event in Uvalde, where members of a special Texas House committee outlined in painstaking detail the delayed and disorganized response by the 376 law enforcement officers who had arrived after the shooting began. The governor had previously stated that although he had called for special legislative committees to examine the Uvalde events, it was not his job to direct their investigation or to prejudge their findings. Even though many of the Uvalde residents who attended Sunday's event called for accountability from Abbott, legislative leaders and the law enforcement agencies, Abbott's office pushed back at suggestions that the governor is seeking to put the tragedy in his rearview mirror. On Monday, Abbott released a statement saying the committee's findings were beyond disturbing and raised serious concerns about the response by officers at the scene. The governor did not lay out any specific policy changes he would pursue. There are critical changes needed as a result of the Texas House's findings, he said in the news release. With multiple investigations still ongoing, including those by the Texas Senate, FBI, and Texas Rangers, we will begin working with the legislature to develop and implement the necessary changes to improve public safety, school safety, and mental health assessment and treatment. Abbott's most recent public events have sought to play the governor's strong suit. On July 14th, the governor visited the Houston Crime Lab, where he met with law enforcement officers to discuss what he called an escalating crisis in the use of the illicit and sometimes deadly synthetic opioid fentanyl. But most reporters' questions related to Uvalde. 4 days before that, the governor was the keynote speaker at an event for the Texas Restaurant Association. But what little news coverage the event received was dominated by a Houston restaurant owner's decision not to attend because she opposed Abbott's immigration policies. Not attending funerals in Uvalde by itself is unlikely to affect the attitudes of ordinary Texans about Abbott, Kronberg said. You can't expect the public to independently come to that conclusion, he said. But going dark in a crisis and coming out with canned messages, Kronberg added, are unlikely to help the governor overcome an actual or perceived empathy deficit. And now sports. Top 10 high school quarterbacks to watch in West Texas in 2022 by Amy McDaniel, published July 25th. Here's a look at our top 10 quarterbacks to keep an eye on during the upcoming 2022 high school football season in West Texas. Number 1, Tyler Hill, San Angelo Central, 6'2", 180, senior. An All-West Texas selection last year, Hill helped make Central make the playoffs in Kevin Crane's first season as head coach. He completed 55.8% of his passes for 1,962 yards and 10 touchdowns. The Bobcats' leading rusher, he had 102 carries for 820 yards and 10 touchdowns. He was part of the Bobcats' sixth place 4x200-meter relay at the Region 1 6A track meet and led Central to a championship bracket appearance at the state 7-on-7 tournament. Number 2, Jamie Boutron, Sonora, 5'8", 175, junior. Last year's All-West Texas Co-Offensive Player of the Year, Boutron was the district MVP after playing quarterback, defensive back, and returning kicks and punts to help Sonora tie for a district championship. The Broncos moved down from Class 3A Division 2 into Class 2A Division 1 for the next two seasons, and Boutron is poised to do damage on both sides of the ball. He rushed for 1,002 yards and 8 touchdowns, passed for 933 yards and 9 touchdowns, and recorded 43 tackles, 7 pass deflections, and a sack. Boutron was part of Sonora's 4x400-meter relay that finished second at the state track meet in the spring. Number 3, Jaden Jackson, Coleman, 5'8", 175, junior. An All-West Texas selection last season, Jackson passed for 934 yards and 12 touchdowns and rushed for 910 yards and 16 touchdowns in helping Coleman to the third round of the Class 2A Division 1 playoffs. Jackson was named his district's offensive MVP. His Blue Cats will enter the season ranked number 9 in the state. In addition to playing basketball, Jackson was on Coleman's third place 4x200-meter relay at the Region 1 2A track meet. Number 4, Trevin Coffle, Erien County, 6'3", 180, senior. Last year's All-West Texas six-man offensive player of the year, Coffle earned All-State honors in two sports and finished fifth at the state track meet to cap his junior year. He passed for 1,729 yards and 35 touchdowns with just three interceptions. He rushed for 495 yards and 10 touchdowns, hit 45 of 57 Pat kicks, and connected on 9 Pat passes. At linebacker, he had 128 tackles and 7 forced fumbles. He led Erien County to the UIL State Basketball Tournament, was MVP of the AWT Boys Basketball Team, and a pick on the AWT Track Team for 300 hurdles. He's a Texas football preseason All-State pick at spreadback. Number 5, Ivan Wolford, Mason, 5'7", 155, senior. A first-team, All-District 14 2A Division I pick at quarterback, Wolford completed 55 of 100 passes for 833 yards and 10 touchdowns against just 2 interceptions in helping Mason win an undefeated district championship. He also rushed for 90 yards and 6 touchdowns while directing the punter's wing tee attack. Number 6, Hayden Baronet Brady, 6'4", 165, senior. The left-hander starts his third season for coach Shea Easterwood. He was a second-team All-District 2-3A Division II pick last year in helping Brady tie with Sonora and Great Creek for their district title. As a pitcher, he earned All-West Texas honors in baseball during the spring. Number 7, Haven Brook Miles, 6'1", 160, junior. In his third year leading the Bulldog offense, Brook comes into the season having led Miles to the Division III championship at the Texas 7-on-7 state tournament in the spring. An All-West Texas selection last year, while leading the Bulldogs to the playoffs, Brook passed for 1,745 yards and 18 touchdowns. He added 550 rushing yards and 9 touchdowns. Number 8, Kyle Lohman, Cristoval, 5'9", 150, senior. In taking over for a 4-year All-Star performer, Lohman passed for 1,278 yards and 18 touchdowns with 6 interceptions last year. Combined with his rushing total, he was the second leading total yard gainer for the District 14 2A Division II champs. The Cougars are moving up to Class 2A Division I. Number 9, Lance Taylor, San Saba, 5'10", 170, senior. Taylor earned second-team All-District 4-2A Division I honors at quarterback last year. He passed for 2,131 yards and 18 touchdowns in helping the Armadillos earn a playoff spot. He was also a first-team All-District catcher in baseball. Number 10, Kaysen Brown, Reagan County, 6'4", 180, sophomore. Brown and the Owls are moving down into Class 2A Division I after playing in one of the toughest 3A Division II districts in Region 1. He passed for 1,345 yards and 10 touchdowns with a 50% completion rate. He was the district MVP in basketball. According to QBHitList.com, Brown has good footwork for his size, makes good decisions, and has a quick delivery. He was noted also for his arm strength and touch. Former Angelo State and Central football standout Donovan Jackson gets XFL draft invite by Charles Bryce, published July 21st. Former Angelo State University and San Angelo Central High School football standout Donovan Jackson has received an invitation to the XFL draft in November. After wrapping up his ASU career this past fall, Jackson caught the eye of some NFL coaches at the Lone Star Conference Pro Day this past spring. He was clocked at 4.45 seconds in the 40-yard dash. Jackson talked to one of the Seattle Seahawks coaches, who took down his number, but he didn't hear back from them. The former Rams linebacker spent the first 4 months of the spring training at APEC in Fort Worth. "I was training with guys like Kansas City quarterback Pat Mahomes and tight end Travis Kelce. Really, almost the whole Chiefs organization was training there. There were some other big names in there. Chiefs receiver Juju Smith-Schuster and all these elite guys. And being surrounded by them, that was very special, and it made me want it even more." The 6'1", 215-pounder had another opportunity in an indoor league in Arizona, which didn't work out, but it ultimately led him to a new agent and new opportunity. "I was out there in Arizona for 3 days, and I just wasn't liking it. So I came back and I got in touch with Griff," Darren Griffin, a sports agent from Galveston, Jackson said. "One of my friend's dads got me in touch with Griff, and he used to play back in his day. I was with that other agency for 4 months when I was in Fort Worth training, and all they were able to get me was an indoor league contract. and I was with Griff for 2 weeks, and he got me an invitation into the XFL draft. That speaks for itself right there. Griff is a good guy, and he looks out for his players, and it means a lot to me. Jackson's hoping to return to Fort Worth for more training at APEC. If you want to fly with the Eagles, you can't be chilling with the pigeons, man, he said. That environment up there just drove me to be the best I could every day. In his final season at ASU last fall, Jackson played in 13 games. He finished with 42 tackles, 25 solos, 3.5 sacks, a QB hurry, and a fumble recovery. The Rams finished 11-3 overall and 5-2 in the LSC. That marked the most wins by an ASU team since 1989, as the Rams reached the third round of the NCAA Division II playoffs for just the second time in program history. Between now and November, Jackson will be trying to get himself into the best shape possible in order to keep his pro football dreams alive. If I get signed by an XFL team, their season is in the spring of 2023, the former Central Bobcat said. And if you do well in the XFL, then I think you have a high chance of going to the NFL. Right now, I'm just still in the waiting game because even though I was invited to the XFL draft, that's not a sure thing until my phone rings and I get that call from a coach. If he gets drafted and makes a name for himself in the new league that made its debut this past spring, Jackson will shoot for his ultimate destination. The XFL is great, and it's definitely a start, and I plan on going in there and dominating and helping out whichever team I may go to, Jackson said. But the NFL is the end goal for me. The Monday before the NFL draft this past April, he got a call from the Indianapolis Colts, who said they could envision him playing strong safety. The Seahawks said the same thing. Hey, I'm just trying to get on the field, and I don't care if I have to snap it, or I don't care if I've got to kick it, laughing, Jackson said. I just want to be on the team. Jackson said playing for ASU in a strong Division II conference like the LSE enabled him to get a shot at the pros. The Lone Star Conference is a very tough conference, Jackson said. When I first came to Angelo, there was Tarleton State and Texas A&M Commerce. Commerce just left for the DI ranks, and they won the national title back in 2017. And West Texas A&M is always a tough opponent. Being in the Lone Star Conference with great competition, I don't care what level you're at, Division I or Division II. We played Abilene Christian, and we played Stephen F. Austin. During a COVID-shortened season in 2020, ASU played four games, including showdowns against Division I schools ACU and SFA. The Rams upset ACU, and they competed well with SFA. I appreciate everything at ASU, Jackson said. I appreciate current head coach Jeff Gersh, and I appreciate former head coach Will Wagner. When I was first there, he gave me the opportunity to be an Angelo State Ram, and then Gersh took over, and it just kept on trucking. Jackson isn't the only former ASU player who is trying to take his game to the next level. One of Jackson's former ASU teammates, safety Devin Washington, is currently on the roster with the Vegas Nighthawks in the Indoor Football League. He did pretty good, and he's still trying to do what he can, Jackson said. I got him in touch with my agent, and former ASU receiver Kellen Pichot will be in the 2023 Pro Day for the LSC. Kellen graduated, but he's still taking classes, so Coach Gersh allowed him to come to Pro Day next year. We talk every day. They're happy for me, and I'm happy for them to keep chasing their dreams. And now here is the weekly wine column by Gus Clemens. Wine capsules beginning to pass into history. What's with the foil or plastic capsule at the top of a wine bottle covering the cork? More pointedly, what is the point of it in the 21st century? The capsule once had a purpose, to protect the cork from mold or nibbling critters in dark, dank wine cellars. Not really a problem today. Wine traditions die hard, and the capsule morphed into a marketing vehicle, or was justified because wine bottles always had capsules. Today's cellars are cleaner, rodent-free, and we drink most of our wine soon after purchase anyway. Capsules no longer serve a purpose beyond aesthetics and branding. Once used, we put capsules in landfills, or we leave them on bottles as potential contaminants at the recycling center. They are a cost to the winemaker and thus to the consumer. The fanciest capsules can add up to $4 to a bottle. Smaller wineries must rent special equipment to place the capsules on the bottle and pay an extra worker to handle the machine. Capsules are an unnecessary hassle to wine drinkers and consumers. The dull knife on a corkscrew has a hard time with most capsules, which means every so often the knife does a better job cutting your thumb than it does slicing around the capsule. Happily, thanks to responsible winemakers, the capsule's time is passing. When you encounter a bottle without a capsule, don't imagine it to be an inferior wine. Instead, rejoice. You have encountered a forward-thinking maker who is putting money into the wine and not packaging. Tasting notes. 19 Crimes, Martha's Chard 2020. Summer Fun Wine and a Bit More. $10 to $12. Ron Ruben Pam's Unoaked Chardonnay 2020. Tasty fruit with a hint of sweetness. $10 to $15. Gansia Prosecco Rosé DOC is a delight to the eye, both in the dramatic bottle and in the glass. Light Delight, $13. Pommery Lewis Pommery California Brut. Sips like old world champagne, but with a fruity California twist. $19 to $22. Stag's Leap Viognier, Napa Valley, 2018. Smooth, lovely, accurate presentation of a pure Viognier, $26 to $30. Pernarlis Cellars Petite Sirah, Farmhouse Vineyards, Texas High Plains, 2018. Rich, smooth, tasty, 100% Petite Sirah from an exceptional Texas winery, $60. Last round. Dear Math Quiz, isn't time you grew up and solved your own problems? Wine time. Email wine at cwadv.com. Newsletter gusclemens.substack.com. Website gusclemenwine.com. And now here's the column from Allison Watkins. Irrigating trees correctly is critical in this scorching summer heat. Published July 21st. The extreme heat and persistent drought has significantly stressed landscape plants and is expected to continue through the summer. Shade trees, ornamental trees, and shrubs are the most permanent, valuable plants in the home landscape and should be irrigated thoroughly to reduce stress and help them survive these rough conditions. Many well-adapted and established trees and shrubs can get by on rainfall, supplemented with lawn irrigation, and don't always need their own separate irrigation efforts. Pecan trees are an exception and will always need irrigation every 2 to 3 weeks in normal years. And in the current conditions, it's recommended to also water the well-established, drought-tolerant landscape trees like live oaks. Even if drought does not kill a tree, the stress can have significant and long-lasting effects. Many insect pests and diseases affect stressed trees much more than healthy ones, and the stress may impact the health of the tree for years to come. Large trees should not be watered just at the trunk. The large woody roots there do not absorb water. They transport it. The goal should be to irrigate the entire root zone, which extends beyond the canopy. Start by watering low and slow at the drip line of the tree. By letting the water hose run on low or using a hose end sprinkler or drip tubing, let it run long enough to thoroughly saturate the ground under the tree canopy and even beyond the width of the canopy. Generally, 2 to 3 inches of water per inch of trunk diameter is sufficient, or simulate a 1-inch rainfall over the entire rooting zone. Water in the morning or evening to reduce wasting water, which is lost to evaporation in hot temperatures. Frequency of irrigating trees depends on the type of tree and how well established it is. Young trees with small root systems should be checked every week, while large, mature trees should be watered every 2 to 3 weeks as long as the drought continues. Save the date and join us Friday, August 19th at the Tom Green County Extension Office at 12 p.m. for a lunch and learn seminar titled Every Drop Counts, Beautiful Landscapes with Less Water. The one-hour discussion will focus on drought-tolerant plant selection and how to save water by increasing irrigation efficiency. For more info and to RSVP, contact Susan with the People Plant Connection at 325-656-3104. Allison Watkins is the Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Agent for Horticulture in Tom Green County. Contact her at aewatkins@ag.tamu.edu.
Thank you for joining us for this reading of the San Angelo Standard Times. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.